I want to formally introduce Karen Fraser Gitlitz. She has a Master of Divinity in Religion from the Vancouver School of Theology. She was ordained by the Unitarian Church in Vancouver in 2008 and has been the three-quarter time developmental minister at the Unitarian Congregation of Saskatoon since August of 2012. Before that, she was at the First Unitarian Fellowship of Nanaimo, and the Gitlitz part of her name comes from her husband, Paul Gitlitz, who is a musician and a producer.
Our first reading this morning is from Douglas Wood. Jack pines are not lumber trees, and they won't win many beauty contests either. But to me, this valiant old tree, solitary on its own rocky point, is as beautiful as a living thing can be. In the calligraphy of its shape against the sky is written strength of character, survival of wind, drought, cold, heat, disease. In its silence, it speaks of wholeness, an integrity that comes from being what you are. Our second reading is by Fred Campbell from his book on religious integrity. A person has integrity when their words communicate congruence with personal experience and the experiences of other people. People have integrity when they say what they mean and do what they say. Their words describe reality as others remember it and experience it. This is what it means to tell the truth. I hear the truth when someone puts into words what I have experienced or may experience in the world in which we both live. Campbell goes on, if you have ever attended a religious worship service with a congregation of your choice and found yourself unable to say or believe some of the words of a creed or sing some of the words of a hymn, then you have experienced the crisis of integrity. If you have had silent reservations about some parts of the service, then you know the tension existing at the root of religion's crisis of integrity. When worship does not deal with the world as you know it, or fails to add meaning to your life, then that religion conducting such worship has a problem of integrity. End of reading. As human beings, we share many experiences. We thirst, we hunger, we grow tired, we feel full, we feel love. And although we might not be conscious of them in the moment, we are all born and we all will die. These experiences are universal, yet our understanding of them varies widely. We approach water and thirst differently when we live in a desert as opposed to by the shores of a river or a lake. We respond to death differently, depending on our beliefs about what happens afterward, and our happiness or unhappiness with the experiences of our own lives. How do we make meaning out of the events of our lives? How do we live with grief and loss? What happens after we die? Looking around in a Unitarian congregation, it seems like there isn't any one strategy. Some find inspiration in poetry or art. Some find joy in the practice of particular traditions. Others turn primarily to science for their understanding of how the world works. Some seem less interested in any sort of belief and more focused on community building or social action. In his career as a Unitarian minister, Fred Campbell served 11 different congregations. As he listened to the stories of people's lives, he began to discern patterns in this diversity of strategies. From those who'd been dissatisfied or upset with the previous religious community, he learned that membership in a community is not worth it if membership requires crossing one's beliefs or values in a significant way. Belonging is meaningless if it does not address the reality of our worldview. In seminary, I had a friendly conversation or argument with an Anglican colleague who pointed out that Unitarians are not quite as unique as we like to think. Because, she said, there are agnostics and atheists and humanists in Anglican congregations too. Indeed, there are. I don't disagree with that. I know some of them. The question that I asked was, would those atheists and agnostics in your congregation feel comfortable standing up on a Sunday morning and speaking to the congregation about their atheism or agnosticism? This is the difference. Campbell calls it integrity. In my experience, the people who are drawn to our congregations don't want to hide. They value the call to be themselves and speak their truth. They're searching for a community that celebrates joys and sorrows of life passages in a way that's meaningful to them. The paradox is, just as they are drawn together by this experience of religious or spiritual or philosophical freedom, they find it difficult to express what they do share. In part, I think, because of the biases of traditional religious language. It just doesn't fit. In English-speaking North America, religious language is drawn primarily from Christian and sometimes from Buddhist and Jewish traditions. And this absence of a useful, usable vocabulary has led Unitarians to be focused primarily on their differences. And as a result, we're less aware sometimes of what we have in common and less knowledgeable about the threads that bind us all together. What Campbell wanted to do was find a way of helping people identify differences and similarities so that there could be meaningful conversations about the range of beliefs and philosophies as well as the common threads. Campbell identified four distinct strategies or ways of being Unitarian based on how people approach some of the basic questions of the human condition. He called these four ways humanism, naturalism, mysticism, and theism. And they were based essentially on people's responses to four questions. So here are the four questions. The first one is, where do you turn to when you're wanting to make meaning out of your life? What are the sources you turn to when you are faced with difficulties or bad news? Second question, what do you rely on for your best knowledge about how the world works? Where do you find your information? What sources have the most authority for you? Third question, how do you respond to your own mortality? What do you believe happens after we die? And how does that influence the way you live your life? Finally, the fourth question. What language do you like to use when you're addressing these questions? Where do your metaphors come from? Now, before I describe Campbell's four basic strategies in a little more detail, I want to be clear that they're not mutually exclusive. Of course, there are more than four ways of being Unitarian. And many of us have bits and pieces of all of these strategies. Some of us will have a greater tendency towards one or two. Others might draw from different ones at different times. This is about finding a language to talk about what we do. So this morning I invite you to try on each of these four ways as if somebody had given you four sweaters to try on. And you get to pull them on and see, how does this one fit? Maybe this one is quite comfortable. Maybe that one is a little too tight. And maybe I don't like to show my belly button anymore. It needs a tug. So let's just try these on, see how they fit. Let's start with humanism. Modern 20th century humanism has had a profound impact on Unitarianism. And in fact, it was very much shaped by Unitarian participation. Many of the people who signed the first Humanist Manifesto in 1933 and the most recent one in 2003 were Unitarians, or are Unitarians. One of the authors of the 2003 Humanist Manifesto was a longtime member of the Unitarian Church of Vancouver. That 2003 manifesto was meant to represent a consensus of the things that most humanists can agree on. It begins by saying that humanism is a progressive philosophy of life that affirms our ability and our responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good of humanity without reference to supernaturalism. Meaning, for humanists, comes from participation in the human community. Humanists often care deeply about justice, and they want to make life better for all. Faced with questions about the end of life, humanism often focuses on the legacy of lives lived. What carries on after our death is the memory of the love that we shared, the impact that we had on people whose lives we influenced and affected. Humanism draws its best knowledge about the world from science and scientific method. And this is reflected in humanist language, which often draws on science as a source of metaphor and imagery. Philosopher and theologian Alfred North Whitehead, for example, used our understanding of how cells work together to form organs and how organs come together to form organisms to talk about how our beliefs grow and develop. Others have turned to evolution, genetics, and quantum physics, all in the service of finding a vocabulary of wonder and awe that fits with a more naturalistic understanding of the world. This brings us to our second way of being, naturalism. Meaning for naturalists comes from participation in the natural world. We are all a part of the interdependent web of life. Accepting our place in the order of things is an important part of personal development for naturalists. They encourage us to accept the natural cycles of life and death and our place in the larger whole. Best knowledge for naturalists comes from nature. Both our scientific understanding of the natural world and our emotional and aesthetic responses to the beauty and drama of the world around us. Like humanists, naturalists want to know what science has to tell us about how the world works. Naturalists also encourage us to reflect on our own experiences out in nature and to value the role of beauty in our lives. Authors such as Henry David Thoreau, or more recently Annie Dillard, David Abram, and Barbara Kingsolver bring insight and understanding to the human condition by placing us in our natural context. Naturalists turn to the natural world and its processes for their metaphors, either their own observations of animal behavior or the scientific theories of change and development. So you can probably see that humanism and naturalism have much in common with each other. Both value and pay attention to science. Both want nothing to do with supernatural beings or magical thinking, as they would call it. Likewise, our second pair, mysticism and theism, are also closely linked. Let's turn to mysticism. Meaning for mystics comes from the same place as their best knowledge of the world. It comes from personal experiences of connection and belonging. Ralph Waldo Emerson is a classic Unitarian mystic. Walking outdoors in the fullness of summer, Emerson describes an experience in which his mind opens, and he gains an intuitive understanding of that which is larger than himself. For Emerson, beauty, truth, and moral insight are learned intuitively through such experiences, which are then conveyed through poetic language and understanding. Old metaphors, old stories, often feel empty to the mystic, who must renew them or reinvent them in order to bring them to life. Mystics often operate in areas where science has made few inroads. Mystics, especially Unitarian mystics, are not necessarily interested in God or the supernatural. They are more likely to describe their experiences as part of their natural birthright as human beings. The most obvious aspect of the use of language in mystics is their dislike of labels for whatever it is that they are connecting with. They do not want to be pinned down. In the words of country singer Iris Dement, mystics just want to let the mystery be. Now, theists share with mystics, a sense of the importance of personal experiences, of connection. But for theists, this connection is highly relational. Meaning for the theist comes from bringing oneself into relationship with that which is larger than oneself, the animating power of life, which may or may not be named God. As with mystics, this power is a real experiential presence. For theists, this relational presence is an intimate part of birth and death, and there is often a connection to a form of life after death, a sense of returning or reuniting with the divine. Like other Unitarians, theists and mystics welcome the knowledge and understanding that comes from the world of science, but scientific understanding is not the first source of authority that they go to in difficult times. Theists and mystics often tune into a personal sense of connection when they are looking for strength and sustenance. Theists and mystics know that knowledge can be gained intuitively as well as rationally. And the mature theist and mystic have a sophisticated understanding of how and when to use which type of knowledge. Like the mystics, theists in Unitarian congregations are frequently misunderstood, especially when they use traditional religious language. And as a result, they can be very shy sometimes and not want to self-identify for fear of being labeled as something that they wouldn't want to associate with either. So what does all this mean for us? A couple of things, I think. First of all, we do have genuine differences in our ways of being Unitarian, and that's okay. One Sunday service committee that I know put it this way: if you haven't been troubled, challenged, or annoyed by any service during the year, we haven't been doing our job. A less confrontational way of putting it is to say, expect that our services will take you to places you might not have otherwise thought to go or even wanted to go. But thank you for hanging out with us for a Sunday. Remember, when you hear language that you might not agree with, to get curious about it. What does it mean for that person? What does spirituality mean for you? Likely something quite different than what it means for me. I was in a congregation once where some folks got quite perturbed about the number of pagans in their congregation. It was sort of a growing thing. Somebody asked, how could people who worship a whole array of gods have anything to do with Unitarians? First of all, we say God is one, and then we say we don't have God, so how do the pagans fit in? Well, on closer investigation, it's not all pagans who are attracted to Unitarian congregations. When people started to talk amongst themselves, they discovered that it was a certain kind of pagan who was attracted to the Unitarian congregation. Often these were pagans who gave significant weight to scientific understanding, who wanted to use democratic processes, who wanted to live out their values of the inherent worth of each person and their interdependent web of life. The same is true of Unitarian theists and even Unitarian Christians. There are many different ways of being a theist, many different ways of being a Christian. But those who end up in a Unitarian congregation often share many values and even beliefs with Unitarian humanists and naturalists. When we allow ourselves to be put off by the language, we run the danger of forgetting to find out what it means to them. And we miss an opportunity to deepen our own understanding of the human condition and how to live out of one's values. If you turn to your gray hymnal for a moment, at the very front, it's the page, where is it? Before the first hymn, looks like this. At the top half is the principles, and these are what we're often most familiar with. And I'd like for a moment to draw your attention to the sources. So the principles are like our statement of shared values. They're the what. The sources are the how of being Unitarian. These are our sources of authority. So it says here that there are a number of things that we pay attention to. Direct experience, the examples, the words and deeds of prophetic men and women, the activists, the people in our lives we admire, wisdom from the world's traditions, including Jewish and Christian teachings, humanist teachings, counseling us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science, and spiritual teachings of earth-centered religions. The weight we give to each of these sources varies from person to person. And this is in part what creates the various ways of being Unitarian. The tension between these sources gives us a wonderfully rich and creative place to explore. Some ways of being Unitarian emphasize the world around us. They encourage us to observe nature and humanity, to name what we see, and to act on our understanding. Other ways of being Unitarian emphasize an acceptance of others, an acceptance of the processes of life, a willingness to let go of expectations, and an encouragement to cultivate our inner sense of connection. The four ways of being Unitarian that Campbell identified emphasize for us our responsibility to figure out our own path. And not just to say, I think I know how I got here, but to figure out where we are going next. What is the next step that will draw us deeper into being who we are, into being people of integrity? All four ways of being Unitarian place an emphasis on this life and what it means for us to flourish in this life. And not just our own flourishing, but our neighbors and all beings. Indeed, all of life on this earth. And this flourishing, this care for living, is the basis of one of the most important things that we share. That we use different language and different metaphors can only enrich our shared lives and our experiences, if we let it. Amen. Blessed be. I understand there's a tradition in this congregation of having congregational response. Helen has the microphone, and she would be happy to bring it to you if you would like to speak.
Thank you very much, Karen. So much to think about. Last week we had a very interesting introduction to philosophy by a doctor of philosophy from the U of R, what you can do in 20 minutes. But it had to do with the subject of ethics. And I was just wondering if you could comment on the thread of ethics through these four ways of being humanist. Or, pardon me, Unitarian.
Sure. I think it has, I'll start with the humanists first. One, the great gift that the humanists have given to Unitarians is a sense of the importance of how events and processes impact individual people. That we pay attention to the results of what happens and the real impact on people's lives. We pay attention to suffering, not to an abstract concept or belief when we're evaluating things. Humanists are also interested in the results of what science has to say. So when our politicians start to talk about this or that policy, humanists are particularly interested to find out if there is any evidence for what they're saying. I could go on about that, but I won't. Naturalists, very similar, particularly interested in the results of science and having evidence-based policies, but also caring for the connections between things. So if humanists have a slightly more, perhaps, distributive approach to justice, looking at the results of what happens to individuals or families or individual people, naturalists are particularly interested in the web of connections and how systems work. So they'll often be more process-oriented in their ethical thinking. Mystics root their... mystics are often great activists, which some people find a bit of a surprise. There's a great book, which I'm now not going to remember the name of. I'll think of it during coffee hour, probably. By the German theologian Dorothea Sola, a feminist theologian who's looked at the various mystical traditions and the activists who have sustained long-time careers in their activism, and finds that they have at their core a sense of connection, that their mysticism leads them to an intuitively felt connection with the natural world or the people around them. And out of that sense of outrage at the breaking of that connection, the things that break that connection, they move forward into activism. Theists often look, if Christian theists will often look to the life of Jesus and the examples there, but also, like the mystics, they have a very relational sense. I think of Mother Teresa, who saw in each person the life of her beloved Savior, the face of her beloved Savior, and in looking at the neighbor, the person in front of you, as an incarnation of the divine. So understanding ourselves as human beings, as all children of God, we're encouraged to go out and do something. That is our neighbor there who is the face of God, who is being hurt, who is homeless, who is sick, who is suffering. And as sisters and brothers in God, we would want to go out and help them. I don't know if that's a kind of a very quick answer.
Bruno, and then Ingrid, and then we'll have to stop, but we do have lunch downstairs, so lots of time for more discussion.
Thank you, Karen. My question is in relation to Islam. Have you ever met a Unitarian minister whose background is basically the Quran, or is not Christian nor Jewish, but Muslim?
I have met a couple of ministers Unitarian ministers who come out of the Hindu tradition. I have met Unitarians who are Unitarian Muslims. I don't think I have personally met a Unitarian minister who comes out of an Islamic understanding. That my personal knowledge of the Unitarian ministers is somewhat limited, so that person may exist, but I have certainly met Unitarian ministers. Well, there are many Unitarian ministers inspired by Buddhism. There's a whole network of them, and actually of Unitarians inspired by Buddhism. There's also a network of Unitarians inspired by Hindu traditions and who come from Hindu backgrounds. In my home congregation of Saskatoon, we have a member who grew up Muslim in Sri Lanka, Nazim Muhajirin, who some of you may know, who has actually spoken to the congregation about the connections that he finds between his Islamic upbringing and his Unitarian philosophy. He gave a very moving sermon, which I won't do justice to, about his experience of a particular festival where the children were asked to come and decide what they were going to give. One of the commandments is to give to charity. and to give to others. And so in his household, the children were asked to set aside a portion of food that they were willing to give up to give to others. So that's an anecdotal experience of one person's connecting the dots, and I would be very interested to know more, and I'm sorry I don't.
Hi. I also imagine a lot of congregations will have certain trends, you know, different trends. But, you know, the idea of pluralism and accepting all religions or everybody's pursuit of truth for themselves, I think we struggle with that, though. And in this congregation and myself, I think we have more difficulty with the theists, particularly those who might come from a Christian background, so that it's kind of a contradiction or a... Yes, it's sort of an irony, I guess.
I think all congregations have what ministers call a dominant theology. There's a sense in which a significant number of the congregation will have a particular view. And amongst a lot of Canadian congregations, especially the fellowships, but not exclusively fellowships, the humanist viewpoint is the dominant viewpoint. And then I think in that case, it is particularly important for those who are in the dominant majority to take some responsibility to make sure that there is space for others to speak. Because I think one of the struggles of our society right now is, how do we deal with pluralism? How do we deal with diversity? Saskatoon had a really big thing last winter about what they were going to put on the bus. You know, the buses have a running thing at the top, and there was this huge controversy about putting Merry Christmas. And, you know, we can laugh about it, but, you know, really, it's symptomatic of a basic struggle about how are we all going to get along together. And here, we are just a microcosm of this, and we are not even as diverse as our whole city. But we can practice it, and we can create in our communities, I think. Last night in the group, we were talking about this a little bit, and I talked about, you know, we can create these little ponds of sanity. And our way of being, and if we can strengthen our way of being, when we take it out into our various volunteer and work commitments, that will ripple out. When we are comfortable with diversity within ourselves, that can have a profound impact on the world around us. Unitarians have a history of punching beyond their weight, or whatever you want to call it, that we've had quite an impact at various times on society in both England and Canada and the United States. And we were never large. We've never been large. But when we've been able to really stand and embody our traditions and live them out in our lives, even just living them out in our families, that is huge. Raising a generation of people who are comfortable with diversity, that will have an impact on the world. No question.